This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We record in the offices of Raider Solutions, a technology company that offers a complete fleet of IT solutions for businesses of all sizes. Raider's motto is, "You just want it to work, we understand." If you're wondering if Raider can help your business, please visit RaiderSolutions.com. I'd like to thank Iberia Bank for its support. Founded in 1887, Iberia Bank is the largest bank based in Louisiana, headquartered in Lafayette, with 329 combined locations throughout the South. They offer the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Visit IberiaBank.com for more information. And lastly, I want to express my gratitude for Lafayette General Health. As Acadiana's largest nonprofit, community-owned regional health system, Lafayette General Health is committed to restoring, maintaining, and improving health in the communities it serves. For more information, visit LafayetteGeneral.com. I'm proud to welcome to the studio today Coley Franson, founder and managing partner of Helical Outpost. Coley's going to talk about hydroponic farming, something which I've been very thrilled to learn about. And this is a type of farming that's done in a controlled environment, protected from the elements, and it doesn't use soil. You can grow the equivalent of about 3 acres of crops in a space as small as 3,000 square feet. Coley's an attorney by trade, and he's transitioned into the agriculture world, and now he's a certified hydroponicist. He also has a background in films that I'm hoping we can touch on. So, Coley, welcome to
the
show.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh,
and thank you to Raider for having us. It's a wonderful place. I wish everybody listening could see how nice this is. It's a very impressive place to be.
It's a wonderful place, yeah. And I want to put in a plug, too. We met through ESA. Your son, Tolson, and my daughter, Kelly, were in the same class. And I know you're still putting kids through school, so God bless you.
Thank you very much. We've got a lot of lettuce to sell.
Yes, you do. I know. So look, let's jump into this, I guess, first with your background. You grew up in Lafayette, and your dad, some people may have known, Dan Franson, who was a founding partner in Stone Energy.
Sure,
and
sure.
And so you've been familiar with processes and entrepreneurship throughout your whole life.
No question. Growing up in Louisiana, particularly in the late 70s and 80s, coming of age was a unique experience for those of us that have any memories left of that time. but it was an amazing place to mm-hmm. be. And growing up with the, I guess, with the tutelage, if you will, of a wildcatter, mm-hmm. You learn to chase your dreams despite any kind of adversity that reliably shows
right.
up when you least want it or expect it.
Yeah, I've heard about that wildcatter mentality, and that's what you're doing now. You moved back here after Katrina with your family, right,
that's
in
correct.
2005, and you've practiced law
that's correct.
For many years.
That's correct.
Yeah.
In many ways, leaving New Orleans and losing everything, which is what we did, we lost resources, time, treasure, talent. A lot of that is imbued in what we do today with mm-hmm. the agricultural stuff that we work on. It's all related in many ways. And looking back, that time of our life that was much of a curse ended up being a great blessing because it brought us home to Lafayette. As an aside, one of the jokes that we always tell is that prior to Katrina, I was a prosecutor in New Orleans, principally involved with juvenile delinquency. And I used to come home at night and ask my wife, gee, we're raising 4 children in New Orleans. It's a different place to be when you have children, when you're single. And she used to say, our kids are in school here, and the only way we're going to leave New Orleans now is an act of God.
Oh,
so our running joke now is, why didn't we say win the lottery? Had to say act of God.
It
really was. It's been a blessing
right.
and a joy to be back.
Right. So you practiced law. You were familiar with the oil and gas industry. And your heart was touched, I guess, to get you into hydroponics. If you can tell the story, kind of a high-level overview of what led you to even know what hydroponics is.
Sure. About 5 years ago, I was approached by some friends of mine that in my former life as a somebody that wanted to go into the film industry. These were folks that I've kept in touch with over time, but they were all friends of mine that were doing films back in L.A., And they reached out and wanted to do an effort to repatriate and employ returning combat veterans. As we were drawing down 1 million people overseas, the idea was to give them a vocational path rather than a benefits path. And the goal was to put these folks into hydroponic agricultural jobs. And I was very skeptical. Mm-hmm. As it was explained to me, hydroponics means, you know, generally growing out of the soil, but you grow in a controlled environment that can mitigate the risks that can bury most farmers, and you get much more high volume, high yield out of the process. So all of that intrigued me enough that I wanted to know more, and I was assured that, you know, there was a path to go train in Southern California. It was a 6-week course. And I was still quite skeptical because my wife is from Crowley, which is a farm town. And so I said, sign me up. And 6 weeks later, I graduated from the course with a certificate.
I know. I'm glad you brought that. I'll have to get a picture of it.
Yeah.
Certified.
That's right.
Hydroponicist.
That's right. And that's one of many. I had a lot of paper that came out of that. It was a really wonderful program, particularly involving transitioning service personnel 6 to 9 months before separation from the military. So there was a lot of really wonderful paper that came out of it, congressional documents with fancy seals, and just so happens the one I grabbed today is the certified hydroponicist paper. But long story short, I went through it and came away with conviction, if you will, that the idea of hydroponic growing makes a lot of sense. The theory behind it makes
right.
a lot of sense.
And not just that it employs people, but that it...
Correct.
We can get into that. I mean, it's sustainable farming.
That's right. And so my takeaway, quite simply, was going through it basically to do due diligence to see if it could actually work. My attitude was, if you can teach me how to grow something, then you can teach anybody, because the best thing I can grow is weeds. I got a flower bed to prove it.
And not the marijuana.
Not
pot,
the marijuana.
The,
although when you say hydroponics, and everybody thinks you're growing not lettuce.
Yeehaw.
That's right. My takeaway from that experience was the theory was wonderful. The execution was not so wonderful, meaning the training we got was a lot of theory, and theory doesn't pay the rent. So, you know, a lot of what we studied were soil types, root zones, and when you're growing hydroponically and you're not in the soil, well, to me it was a frustrating kind of a allocation of time, because we're studying things that will have no bearing whatsoever on what it is we're supposed to do. And the whole time that I was in this program, I was the only civilian in a class of 30 people, roughly. The general takeaway, myself included, was I just want to learn how to get trained in something and get a paycheck.
Right.
I'll work really hard. You give me the standard operating procedure, and I'll do that.
And
that's what was lacking.
Right.
There was no standard operating procedure, because in the world of ag, there's no standard.
Do you know, Coley, you went out to California. Is hydroponics something that most states are using, or is this something that's still very
unique? Oh, there's no question it's evolving.
It is.
And, you know, as a starting proposition, it's helpful to think about the technology, which really goes back to the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, right? We think of hydroponics as some new hippie technology. Well, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon was an irrigation project that got plants out of the soil.
And grown in water.
And it was, you know, miracle, right?
Uh-huh.
And really what it was an irrigation effort to do hydroponics. So it's an old technology.
Right.
That, of course, today has been buttressed or built onto by modern technology. So the technology is quite old.
So Helical Outpost is your company. I know you've got a partner, Dylan Radigan, am I saying that right, who was a former MSNBC host and I think going back into TV with this. Would you explain what a pod is for people that are listening and may still be going, what are they talking about? You grow vegetables.
That's
I guess
correct.
You can, I don't know if you can grow fruits
and things.
Well, let me
back up.
I want to give them a picture in their mind of what we're talking about.
So what you see right now, if you talk about pods and growing in pods, a lot of people think you're growing inside of a shipping container. Shipping container farming has been kind of a vogue technology that captures everybody's imagination, right? You see a shipping container, it's got pink lights in it, and man, you push a button on an iPhone and things spin. It's very captivating. That's not what we do. Our approach really is a standardized commercial farm that's loaded into a container. So a container shows up on site, you open the doors, you unpack it and set it up, and you leave the container on site, it's modified to be safe storage for food safety regs, and also to be a point of sale for a community. So if you drop it into a community, you've got a way to have food production on site, water filtration, satellite communication, and power production all in the same spot. That can allow people then to come on site and purchase the food that's grown there, or in fact, you know, bring their own stuff to market. So what we talk about is really straightforward for those that are driving and stuck in the Atchafalaya Basin right now. What we are talking about is a container that opens up and a big greenhouse sets up next to it. It's that simple.
And so what types of vegetables, like we're looking now, I know you brought basil and lettuce. What do you grow in hydroponics?
We grow currently. We grow several varieties of lettuce, a green oak, red oak, and a butter leaf lettuce. We also grow basil, we grow microgreens, we grow tomatoes, and that's our laundry list at the moment. To date, we've grown edible flowers, we've grown spinach, kale, Asian blends, beets, oddly enough, which we didn't grow, of course, till fruition, but we grew them and then transplanted them outside into the soil. I'm trying to think. We've grown heirloom tomatoes. We've grown peppers. We've grown cucumbers.
How do they take root? Like, how does
that's a great question.
The process work?
That's a great question.
Because I know they grow fast once they're in the pod.
That's right. So when you're growing hydroponically, whether it's vining crops or whether it's leafy greens, vining meaning your tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, you will typically have some kind of a medium. So for our tomatoes, we use... perlite. Perlite is it's a material, it's an inert little, like almost like little white rocks, and you see them oftentimes in potting soil, and that is, as I understand it, something left over from quarrying operations when they're doing limestone, so it's left over small pieces of rock that we put into a bag, and then as the plant takes off, it gives the roots something to have structure.
Yeah.
That's right. It has no nutritious value or anything like that. It's simply there as an inert substance to allow the roots to grow. And then the water that's added, that has the nutrients. So in that case, then, what you have is you have plants that are out of the soil. They are in a growing medium, and that medium is something simply to let the roots bind onto as water then is trickled over those roots with nutrients to deliver the nutrients to the plant. And then on the leafy green side, we use Oasis, which is a pre-cut. It's almost like a sponge. It's a little rectangular material. It's the, if you buy flowers, Oasis is that little spongy material that's often in the vase that the stems are sticking into. We use a version of that that's designed for hydroponic growing, which we really like because it's pre-cut and it's very easy to work with. You can also use, you know, cocoa husks is a common thing. You can use soil. Anything that allows the roots something to bind to is what we use.
Right. And so the water, you know, I was going back over my notes while you were talking about that. Hydroponic farming uses a lot less water than
no
regular
question.
Farming, and you've got it filtered, right?
That's
it's like 2,000 gallons or something. I'm trying to think what I read.
Sure. Well, and
it sounds technical, but maybe it's not.
That's right. You know. And to bring it back to the audience's focus, right, we're talking about a big rectangular greenhouse sitting next to a shipping container.
All right.
Okay. And inside the greenhouse, for the leafy greens or the lettuce, you have a big reservoir of water, and that water has several hundred gallons. It's got nutrients in it. There's one pump. And that pump pushes water and nutrients around a table, and it goes up to the top of the table, and the table's at a slight lean. So what happens is the water and the nutrients start at the top like a little hill, and it rolls down to the other side of the table where it's collected and sent back into the reservoir. It's called a recirculating system. So that was part of what really appealed to me in the whole world of this effort was, well, gee, we can use 90% less water.
Yeah.
I mean, that is immense, you know. And there is still some water loss because plants do sweat. It's called evapotranspiration. Big word. It just means plants breathe and sweat like we do. So there is still some moisture loss. But it's about 10% of
like what
conventional agriculture
right.
is. And
right.
in the world of conventional ag, if in fact you're putting water down onto the ground with nutrients, it's very expensive water because it's got food in it, and gravity will pull that water down, and once it goes below the root zone, that water and that's lost.
Right.
So to me, part of what really excited me about this hydroponic effort is you're mitigating those areas that, you know, these inputs that are ordinarily very costly and don't always get allocated efficiently to the roots.
Right.
You know, you may spray it on a crop and it may run the wrong direction. It may go away from the roots. So in the case of hydroponics, you're constantly delivering nutrients to a root 24/7.
And that's what accelerates the growth and the health of the plants. And then I also read that you don't touch, like you have to wear gloves. Is that right? You keep everything sterile.
That is correct. You know, part of, you know, as we talk about getting people into farming, there's a very lovely fairy tale kind of image that we all have in our minds of usually a child sitting on a pumpkin with a dog in a field. You know, which is every violation of food safety that you can probably think of.
A dog in particular.
And the kid sitting on the pumpkin, you know. And so the reality is, and part of what our approach has been in this whole effort has been, let's really figure out what it really means to be a commercial farmer. Mm-hmm. Let's deal with the food safety regs. And when we say we're going to crank out something that's going to do all these great things, well, it can only work if it's got commercial value. And if it's going to have commercial value, we're going to have to come in under the food safety regs. And so in our case, everything that we do is GAP certified, meaning USDA has GAP, which stands for Good Agricultural Practices. That's about as fancy as you can get, right? So GAP certified. And we're very excited about that. It's a complexity. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt it's costly. To be GAP certified, now the going rate to have an auditor come visit you is $216 an hour.
Oh my gosh.
There's only one auditor in the state of Louisiana. She's in Hammond. So when we have a food safety audit, we're already $600 or $700 into it by the time she even gets to our farm to set foot
on site. Oh, it's travel time, too.
Travel time.
Oh, my gosh.
So if you're in Shreveport, good luck.
Right. And I learned about you from Zach McMath. I knew you as an attorney. Mm-hmm. And Zach, we've had on the show talking about Acadiana Food Hub and how technical it is to stay in compliance with the USDA and state and other local rules. And so that's when I put all this together about how safe and sterile hydroponics was.
Sure.
Kelly, I want to just take a second. We're going to keep on this topic. I want to thank the Advocate here in Acadiana. They promote our podcast. They promote news of it twice a week. And I want to thank Adam Daigle and the whole business team here in Lafayette at the Acadiana Advocate. So for anybody out there, if you want to sign up, you can go to theadvocate.com and sign up for their daily newspaper.
And I will follow on that and tell you that I'm a proud subscriber of the Advocate.
Me too.
And back when he was still there, David Dacquia had mentioned on Facebook, he asked, how is it that you can spend $10 a month on Netflix and not spend a little bit on your local paper? And it drove home to me that I sit here all day long bragging about local and you should buy local, but then I wasn't buying the subscription. So I'm proud to say that I have been a subscriber now, and I support local, and then local news is as important as local food.
Yeah, I get it every day, both online and in my yard. You know, I'm probably not a good consumer, but I like my puzzles on paper. So, so let's get back into this. I'm picturing, you're talking about the sterility, the water that's used. There's no dogs in there, little girls and pumpkins and all that. So this is something that people of all ages can learn. And I know that here in Lafayette, at John Paul the Great, there is hydroponics.
That's right.
Farming going on. Can you talk about that and what the kids are learning?
I know Sean
East runs that.
That's right. When we started this whole effort, my takeaway from the farm school I went to was, gee, this is great theory, but horrible execution. And what our hope was to apply oil field thinking to an ag problem. And, you know, oil field, I grew up in it. Everything is designed to be set up rapidly on site, do what you have to do, and then get out, you know, as fast as you can to go to the next site. Everything is designed to be standard operating procedure, unpacked, unloaded, set up, torn down, reloaded, shipped away. That's the thinking that we wanted to apply to this problem that I experienced in this farm school, which was one of the best farm schools in the country. And so when we started, it had never been done before, you know. So you can't go to a bank and say, hey, bank, give us a loan. And the bank's going to say, hey, where's your comps? You know, well, there isn't a comp.
Yeah.
So we had to start somewhere. And in fact, we were going to start at ESA. The head of the school there, Paul Baker, walked us around, and we had a great site picked out. However, where we started ultimately was a wonderful site in many ways, because what we had done was prototyped. So all of the trades that would do the solar and the plumbing and all of that just happened to be around the corner from the school. And the other side of it was the school had a cafeteria, mm-hmm. which the other school did not. Because our big concern was, well, gee, if this thing works, we're about to crank out a lot of produce. Where are we going to go with that? Mm-hmm. And so the other side of that location there is it's close to the Carmelites,
right.
which they have their own garden. And in fact, I always joked with Sister Amy, I said, the longer you pray over here, the closer we get to the Carmelites. And so we ended up there. And of course, it was close to St. Joseph's mm-hmm. Diner, which
right.
is how we started.
That's what I read, that was one of your first clients, huh?
And our thought was, you know, just like wildcatting, you know, you've got a 90% chance of failure. And if you're going to fail, do it in a way that helps the school. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, that has not been the case. In fact, what we've done is what we had hoped to do, which was set out to prove that there is, in fact, a market. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you even know people are going to buy what you grow?
How long has it been at John Paul the Great?
Well, it's been running there for about 3 years.
Oh, okay.
It got there probably 4 years ago, mm-hmm. and then we worked on it and had lots of false starts and, you know, things that expectedly, unexpectedly, mm-hmm. Presented new issues to learn. So we've been there growing for about 3 years now.
That's
commercially.
A gorgeous campus. So for people that aren't familiar with that, that's, like you said, right by the Catholic Diocese.
That's right.
And Carmelites. It's on Carmel Drive.
And there is no
gorgeous,
question. It's
gorgeous.
Been a blessing to be there.
Uh-huh. And it's a small school.
Absolutely.
What is it, K through 12?
K through 12.
Uh-huh.
And they're growing.
Are they all
not growing food. They're growing in enrollment and everything else.
They are, yeah.
Oh, sure.
That's good to hear.
Yeah. Wonderful school. And we're very grateful that they would even have us. You know, it is an imposition, but by the same token, where our focus has been from day one is, how do you get this to the next generation? And it's an important thought, because when we started all of this stuff, what knocked me out of my orbit in practicing law was, you know, I went out to this farm school, and I expected to not learn anything. And while I was there, it dawned on me, and what was taught to us was shown, that the average age of farmers is 60 years old and rising.
Right.
And there's nobody coming in behind the farmers to pick that up. So if you extrapolate that time forward 20 years, we don't have farmers. You know?
And, you know, we've seen that locally.
Sure.
You know, Gotro Farm, so many people, it's very tough.
It's a tough living.
To be a farmer.
And then the concern was nobody's coming behind us. So mm-hmm. a lot of the folks that we started this with, one of them was a gentleman named Scott Kornberg, who died. His company is American Hydroponics, that we're very proud to work with. They've set up science barges in the Hudson River. They've set up rooftop growing, huge installations all over the world, all the way down to little ones. And Scott's big argument was, you know, if we're going to get to the next generation, we have to put it on their terms. Right. We have to be able to get to them. And I've amended that. You know, now my comment is, if we're going to get to the next generation, we got to make it at least as sexy as Snapchat, because that's what the kids are on these days.
Well, how do you do that? How
well,
do
that's
you make
right.
farming sexy?
Well,
I mean, this looks like a lot of fun, though, looking at the pictures
is.
Of the kids. They're enjoying
no
themselves.
Question. So. No question. The big issue that kids are going to run into today is, you know, they don't want to be with the creepy crawlies. They don't want to be with the worms and the weeds and the bugs, and because they could be on Snapchat. So that's your opportunity cost. How do you get them to get past Snapchat? Well, a lot of what we do, and what we've been very excited about with the kids, is by growing hydroponically, they're out of the worms and the weeds and the mm-hmm. bugs. So they start, everything's table height. You don't crawl around and get into all of that. And it's high volume, high yield, right? So
how high volume? Like, what can you grow in a pod? How much
gosh.
Lettuce? They grow a lot of lettuce.
No question. Uh-huh. No question. We're doing hundreds and hundreds of pounds a week.
That's amazing.
Yeah, out of a tiny little spot.
Right, right.
And that's just, and we're only using a portion of the growing area. You know, we have other stuff allocated to tomatoes and things like that. So you can get quite a bit out of it, and you're always seeding. You know, mm-hmm. every week you seed. I'm going to be seeding after we finish here today. My next stop is back at JPG with okay. hundreds of seeds to go plant. And
are the prices on these, like the cost to grow it, Coley, Is it comparable to buying organic? I know that they're now labeled organic, even though they're not grown in soil.
Well, they can be, right? We might have to allocate a whole nother hour just to talk about organics and hydroponics. The simple answer to that is there's a big issue going on for people that grow in the soil that don't necessarily like hydroponics being labeled organic. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of things that have to fall in place. Just because you grow something hydroponically doesn't mean you're organic. You know, we'd want to look at the nutrients that you use. Are they going to be what's called OMRI listed, meaning there's an organic, I forget what OMRI stands for, but you see it if you're ever at Lowe's on the thing, it'll say OMRI listed in the organic pesticide section.
So there may have to be like a separate designation at some point.
That's what they're talking about.
Off,
the USDA has struggled. Uh-huh. They have struggled for years. When I went through farm training, I went to a certified hydroponic organic basil farm. And then a couple of years after I graduated, hydroponics could no longer be associated at all with organics. And then, in the last year or two, USDA has come back out and kind of reversed their position again. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it's the National Organics Board that has come out, and they have now allowed it mm-hmm. again. So this thing goes back and forth, whether or not something's organic or not.
But
and
the bottom line is, it hadn't been in the soil. It hasn't been sprayed with
that's right.
you know, all these chemicals
sure.
that other produce may
that's
have been
correct.
Sprayed with. So,
and it's an important thing. I guess one of the things, as we're talking about it, you know, now that we're on it, when we say organics, right, most people say, is something organic? And so if you ask them, well, what do you mean, right? Nobody really knows. I mean, as it's not a legal challenge. It's really, what's the definition? And man, if you ask anybody today, like if I asked you today, what is organic? What is that?
Yeah, I think it'd be clean without chemicals.
Clean
but
without
I don't know
chemicals.
If that's right. You know?
That's correct. And that's where so many people come in. And
that's what this is.
And what I mean is clean without chemicals. I say it's correct that you know what you think it means.
Mm-hmm.
But
I don't know what the USDA
that's
thinks
right.
it means. Yeah.
Well, and organic started by the Rodales way back. Mm-hmm. Gosh, I can't remember how long ago it was. And the mm-hmm. Rodale Institute is here today, and they still do wonderful work.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it flows from organics, which is a process, right? And it's a process that nurtures the soil. There's a whole universe of living things in the soil. We really want to care for that. And over time, our agricultural practices have included people that inject liquid nitrogen into the soil, and they'll do it over a tremendous amount of acreage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you freeze dry everything in the soil, so now all your beneficial worms and your beneficial insects, they're gone. So you're killing the soil before you come down and put down all of your crops. And then you have to put a lot of nutrients and all these additives that are designed for that process. So organics, in many ways, was designed to avoid all that. Let's nurture the soil. So When we say it's something organic, we're talking about a process. But over time, it's come to be equated with a product. So today, when you see organic on a label, you say, it's organic. Well, there's the label. It's like a Mercedes-Benz logo, right? You see it and you know it's organic.
Yeah, it must be the best.
That's right. It must be the best. It must mean it's chemical-free. That's another one. Everybody says, well, everybody knows organic is chemical-free. Well, if that's the case,
maybe
there would
not.
Be no organic pesticide section at Lowe's. The reality is they are spraying chemicals all over it. But it's on OMRI, which is a list of designated products
safe
that you can use and get the label. And the interesting thing, and it's one of my visual aids that I did not bring today, and I would invite anybody listening to go next time you're in Lowe's, go to the organic gardening section and pull back the warning label on organic pesticides and look at all those warnings. It'll kill fish. It may kill honeybees.
Don't sprinkle it on your cereal.
Do not consume it. Don't put it near elders, children, animals.
Right.
But it's OMRI listed, and you can use that, and that would be allowable to get an organic designation.
So a head of lettuce grown hydroponically versus a head of lettuce grown organically.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know this. Do they have the same nutrients then if this doesn't derive itself from the soil?
The nutrient density is wonderful. In fact, because you're...
So that's not an issue.
No. And now where people might get, you know, if they want to get into the distinction of the hypertechnicality of nutrients, then they may want to say, well, you're using OMRI-listed nutrients.
Okay.
That's another big issue. Mm-hmm. So let's say that. So our experience with OMRI-listed nutrients has been they've been unpredictable at best.
This is an evolving field.
That's correct.
Yeah.
You know, one of the areas that I think we're very excited to at some point explore would be how we can use Louisiana sugarcane to make our own OMRI listed nutrients, you know, but it's like you only have 1440 minutes in a day, mm-hmm. so you can't allocate, you can't do it all.
So what, I know that you source your lettuce and other things to Whole Foods.
That's correct.
Let's say. So are the prices comparable, like hydroponically grown
sure.
lettuce? Is that, I think I was getting at that earlier, is this something that's even higher end or is it a
no question.
Similar cost?
It depends. It's going to depend on your store. You know, mm-hmm. in California, where you know they have so much grown everywhere, it may be cheaper. In different, like here in Louisiana, you may find that it's more expensive for organic, just mm-hmm. because to get it here and all of that. And a lot of that's going to be a function of the food industry itself. You know, one, it's really not a distinction so much on organics versus hydroponics. It's really going to come down to economies of scale and the source of the farm. You know, a lot of right. these farms have thousands of employees down in Mexico cranking out produce as fast as you can imagine, and it mm-hmm. comes in dump trucks and gets onto a conveyor belt and gets shredded and packed. And so when you have that kind of an economy of scale, you can bring in product at a
less
lower
expensive,
price.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the nature of it.
And I know that you also source for many local restaurants. If you want to touch on that.
I'm very happy to. We would not be here without our local restaurants. As a starting proposition, it just wouldn't happen. Because when we started, again, we started on a hope and a prayer. And we were a homeless company serving homeless people. That's pretty much what we were.
I never thought of you like that.
Well, it was. I mean,
the truth comes out.
We were.
It's a big gamble.
It was a yeah. tremendous gamble. Laid awake a lot at night, and still do. Still kind of laugh and say, "Man, I could have been a title attorney on this mm-hmm. one." You know, working in the air conditioning, getting paid at the closing, not bad. And that's no disrespect to title attorneys who
thank you.
They yeah. also work like crazy. So I've seen how hard they work as well. So. At the end of the day, though, when we started, we didn't know. And it's really funny, and I will say this now, I've been at it long enough that I feel more comfortable saying it. The farm school that I went to was sponsored in part by Whole Foods. We had a Whole Foods forager there as part of the training. There's a 30-minute documentary on it. They're all over it.
What is it called? Forager?
A forager.
Okay.
So at Whole Foods, you have folks that it's their job to forage. They go out and they find product. And at the time, what was told to us was if you go through this program and you come out as an alumnus or an alumna of this program, you're going to be on a preferred vendor list at Whole Foods. So that's great. I can go set up my farm and sell. Fast forward years later, you know, we're talking to a forager here saying, okay, look, we've done it. We've started. Mm-hmm. And the forager here said, there's no such thing. We don't have a preferred vendor list. So it's kind of a comeuppance.
Mixed message.
And it may be, you know, I don't know how to look back in time and resolve that other than perhaps the company was so big that perhaps there was in this one region, but mm-hmm. there wasn't across the country because you're dealing with such a large group. So in many ways, that was a blessing for us because we had to go back and get onboarded traditionally. So there's no way that you can look at that and say, oh, well, since you went to this farm, you had some magic wand that got you in. Far from it. We had to work and go through multiple levels of an onboarding process that was very difficult. But we're very proud of that because Whole Foods has a very rigorous food safety mm-hmm. Plan in place. And, you know, you're not allowed in the door unless you can deliver safely. So for us, that was a huge step. The other side of where we were was also at the school that I went to, they had a representative from something called PROACT. PROACT is a national distribution co-op of all these food distributors around the country. Every state has one member of PROACT. In this state, it's Capital City. And the PROACT representative was telling all of us, 29 military folks and one civilian, that if you build your greenhouse, call your PROACT member and they'll back the truck up and you'll live happily ever after. Well, okay, fast forward a few years and call up Capital City. Say, hey, you know, went to this school, and the PROACT representative said, you guys will send a truck. And the gentleman over there.
What?
The gentleman over there.
He told you that.
Correct. And, you know, and that was also a comeuppance because the gentleman I was speaking over to there said, hey, listen, I don't know who you spoke to, but I'm in the business office. And that was sales. Salespeople lie. because this is business and we can't justify to stop for an economy of scale versus a certain size. So all of that is part and parcel of why I say we wouldn't be here today without our restaurants, because what we quickly realized was that there is no magic bullet. So the only way that we could survive and live the fight to get to the point where we could actually make the case to Whole Foods and say, listen, take us on our merits, not on our story, was through the faith of our restaurants.
Well, they're really wanting to sell farm to table
food. No question.
Food,
so. No question. And so for us, you know, our first big buyer was Cafe Josephine up in Sunset. Chef Troy up there, who is every bit as rigorous as Whole Foods, was huge and remains huge for us. And then Social, Saint Street Inn, Blue Dog, before that, Dark Rue, you know, Cafe V, Bread and Circus, Pamplona, all of these have been incredible.
And some of our finest restaurants.
No question.
Also.
No question. And it's a real blessing to be able to go through the back door of these restaurants. You know, it's funny, before I did all this, I didn't realize there was always a back door into a restaurant.
Now, are you the delivery man?
I am. I am. I wear all the hats. I'm a certified delivery guy, too.
I thought I saw that other certificate in there.
That's right. So part of why we're doing that, incidentally, really has been, when we started, it wasn't just to prove that we can have this neat widget or gadget that drops on and grows all the stuff. The reality is, if we're going to ask people to grow with it, we have to walk in their shoes. We've got to understand, what are these folks going to be dealing with? You know, how do we grow? How do we get stuff packed and delivered? You know, and
you're really on the very front end of what could happen. This could be just
that
exploding industry. I know that's your goal. And I also know, Coley, that while you're trying to sell what you're doing, you also have a heart where you want to help people that are in food deserts. So we're talking about a commercial endeavor that also can help change people's lives.
There's no question.
That shop at Dollar General only because there's no other store in the area.
No question.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that, you know, I started in Jefferson Parish at Gretna in Manhattan at the Juvenile Justice Center. And my takeaway when we were going through that, I used to talk to the indigent defense attorney across the table. Every day we'd sit across the table from each other, and in between calling up one case to the next, to the next, to the next, we would talk. And the things that we saw, particularly with juveniles, was that they had so much potential. They just didn't have a shot, you know? And in these communities, my running joke was, give me the juvenile drug dealer. They can do fractions in their head. They can convert grams to ounces. They understand time value of money. They can market. They just don't have a legal product. You know, if we can shift and create a better alternative, well, they can put all those skills to work doing something that then can build community value, you know? And so in a lot of these places, that was an exposure that I saw that I would love nothing more than to get back and bring fresh produce and jobs to these communities. They recently had, over in Macomb Vizé, they had a big grant that came through. And I went to attend a Department of Transportation meeting at Macomb Vizé, and they put up these big whiteboards, and they asked everybody that was in attendance from the community, let's list your top 10 or top 20 things that you want if money is now on the table. And the number one thing on that whiteboard was fresh produce. It kind of blew me away. I was expecting mortgage assistance. That was number two. Yeah. Number one was access to fresh food, because it's easier to get cigarettes and alcohol in a lot of these communities than it is fresh food. So there's no question that what we're working on would have import, and it would be, you know, a dream come true to be able to deliver that kind of value to these communities that need it the most.
Right. For people that want to know more, where should they visit your website?
Yeah, we have our best site really is Facebook and Instagram. We've learned over the years that we prefer to be on social media. You can see a daily log, if you will, of everything that we do. We do have a website that is very informational, almost too much information, and we're in the process now of updating that and streamlining it so that if you look at it, you don't get a shotgun blast.
Yeah. But some of the technical things you were talking about, I think if people can look at those pictures. It's Helical Outpost or Helical Holdings.
Sure, helicalholdings.com, and that will take you, and you can see really the overview and much of what we've said here today.
But the technical things about the solar panels and all the technical details, I think if they can visualize, you know, look at the pictures and
Correct.
Learn more, I really encourage people to go look at your site and spread the word about this, because it's something mainstream people just, I don't think we're aware of it yet, and the potential is unlimited.
Well, it is.
Unlimited.
Thank you for that. You know, and the one thing that I guess I would add to that is, as we've looked at all of this, our approach has been a standardized approach to farming that can mitigate the threats, you know, the weather, the worms, the weeds, the chemicals. All of those things that we've taken, we've done that in an environment of food safety, meeting USDA, and of course the FDA has its own regs. They have something called FSMA, which is the Food Safety Modernization Act, which is on us. It's coming. And these are great things, but they're enormous barriers to entry for new and young farmers. Mm-hmm. If you don't know about it, you're going to find out about it the way that we did. You know, you're going to blunder into it and realize, oh my gosh, I got to do all this. So we welcomed all of that in an effort to detangle it and demystify that in a way that can move stuff forward. And the reason I say all of that is, you know, at the end of the day, you're right on that a lot of people haven't quite embraced it yet. And part of what we're seeing today is we are in a state of change. State of climate change. As we saw in New Orleans, where a lot of people joke that we're the early adopters of climate referees, or climate evacuees, rather, refugees. Climate migration is the word I was looking for. That was a word given to us by Loyola Marymount out in LA when we were talking about all this stuff. So, congratulations. We're the early adopters of climate migration in Louisiana.
But this can help people survive
sure.
to have fresh food.
And it allows us to have something that's flexible, right? Because if you go and you build these massive factory farms and they're cemented into the ground, one hurricane wipes it out, you know? And so the reality is, if you can start distributing agriculture, you can have a lot of impacts that can bring value to our communities. One of the things that we see here, and part of what I brought with me, I brought a whole box of visual aids. And one of them is a state. It's a 151 page document. I'm gonna rifle that just so people can hear what 151 yeah. pages sounds like on a microphone. And that's a procurement guide from the USDA. It's called Procuring Local Foods for Child Nutrition Programs. It's what binds public schools to buy, and any school that wants to buy local will find on page 35 of this 151 page document.
Just what they need to do.
No, they have one headline that says using local as a specification is not allowed. So 150 pages of this document
Wipes
are designed
out. Yeah.
To get around what's on one page of the document says you just can't do it. So our procurement regulations haven't quite caught up. So when you say we haven't, the reason I segued into all of that is where we are today is we are at a point where the technology is such that we can now distribute agriculture and we can bring it local. So one of the things that we see here in Lafayette, for instance, we feed roughly 30,000 kids, three times, maybe four, if the kids go home with food from the pantry. And your child nutritionist may not know where that food's coming from. It's a big issue, right? And it's that way all across the country. You know, a lot of these folks don't know where the food comes from. And if you call the distributor and say, hey, where's my produce coming from? They'll tell you it's shipped from Salinas. It's like, well, okay, but where did it come to get to Salinas?
Right.
I don't know. So part of what we're looking at doing through the effort here long term would be to allow your nutritionists, if we're going local, they have a key to the site. As long as they sign in and check in our visitor log for keep the USDA happy for their inspections, they can come 24/7 and confirm we're not using chemicals. And they can see our cleanliness, make sure where our safety plan is being followed, to give them traceability and accountability that they don't have today.
Right.
The other side of it is, if you look at our educational system right now under CTE, which is our career and technical education, there's only one pathway out of like 47 that's ag. Agriculture, agri-science is three. At least that's what it was last time I looked. And at the time, the teachers hadn't passed the test yet because it was new. And one of the things that we look at is, how do these kids have vocational careers in these trades? And part of the way that they establish a path is, well, you got to show that there's jobs. Then we can justify having the career path. Well, but if there's no greenhouses and no way, then you're division by zero. So a lot of what we're looking to do long term is to solve these issues that can help evolve our communities and our buyers and get them informed to where we can start scaling it out.
Right.
So that was a very lengthy thing to say. I hope I didn't put you all to sleep with that.
No, I mean, there's just so much here. You brought several books. If you want to mention, I know you brought some interesting
I did.
Books.
You know, a couple of things I just grabbed on the way here.
Yeah, what do you recommend people look at?
You know, there's a great book that I did not bring called Last Child in the Woods, which is probably one of my favorite books at all of all, in that research was done by a gentleman that researched what we've seen historically in our community, which is our children have ADHD, obesity, mm-hmm. ADD, diabetes, all these things. And the argument is that we started off as a very agricultural animal, right? For 12,000 years since the Neolithic Revolution, we've dealt with irrigation and agriculture. That's been our identity. And in the last 100 years, we've dropped it. I mean, not just subtly. I mean, we are out. Mm-hmm. It's Snapchat. People just disconnected. So the premise of that is that as we have just suddenly disconnected from what's been our identity for so long, we're seeing anxiety and all these issues.
Mm-hmm. And it's incredible health issues.
Yeah, it really is. So that's a book, Last Child in the Woods, that I look at. And I just happened to grab one called Haddocks, which is it's an interesting story. One of the things that I'm very happy to say that we've done is we've taught public schools, private schools, we've taught veterans, all ages. And in one of the more interesting things was I had a group, Live Oak Academy in Baton Rouge, or Live Oak Middle, that reached out online and just had been reading a book called Haddocks.
H-A-D-D-I-X.
That's right. I'm sorry, that's her name is Haddocks.
Oh, that's
the
name.
Author's name. And the book was Among the Hidden.
Among the Hidden.
And it's one of these near future kind of apocalyptic kind of things. And the premise there is you can only have two kids or only have one kid. I forgot what the magic number is. So the families that have to break the rule have to start growing extra food because government monitors how much food you're buying. So if you're buying more than what two or three people should have. So in the book, these folks resort to hydroponic growing. That way they can do that. Mm-hmm. And so these kids, middle school, just happened to read this science fiction book and then reached out to us, and we had a virtual class. You know, we walked them through, and they set up their own little hydroponics in their class. And so I dragged that because the point and why I brought that along was, you know, kids today do have an interest in all of this stuff, mm-hmm. and they really are.
They probably get it quickly. Huh?
That's right. Yeah. And so the way that we can start getting back to these kids to bring it all full circle is to bring it back on their terms. And one of the things that I think is of interest, we had talked earlier about kids that don't want to get into the worms and the weeds and the bugs, right? The traditional experience of raised bed growing is you throw the seeds down, find out it's a lot of work, you ignore it, and it turns into weeds, right? Well, when we grow the way we grow, hydroponically, the kids always have sense like instant gratification. But even with the instant gratification and almost, I can't say guaranteed success because nothing's guaranteed, but over time, the kids, because they're kids and they're hungry to learn, they'll start saying, well, hey, can we plant acorns? Can we plant beets? Can we plant, you know, and then that's when you know you've kind of got a spark. When they start asking, hey, can we
dot, dot, dot.
That's right. So one of the things that we've always been excited about has been the times that we've propagated beets. Because we'll just say, let's grow them, let's find out. So we'll start doing that, and beets are a root crop. So at some point, you're growing these root crops out of the soil. They start getting too big, you know, to handle in the hydroponics. So then the kids will say, hey, what do we do next? And then you throw it back to them, you know, well, I don't know, what do you think? And they'll say, well, let's go outside and plant them in the soil.
Hmm.
All right. So then, when the kids take that outside, you find out that then the kids are okay with the worms and the weeds and the bugs.
Yeah.
Now they're invested in their beet.
But
they've cared for it.
Yeah,
they've made it
to do it, though.
That's right. Now it's theirs.
Uh-huh.
And so the reason I get into that is because hydroponics really is not a replacement, nor will it ever be, for conventional growing. But it's a supplement mm-hmm. that can get these kids to the, you know, the next generation interested in growing. And it can certainly have needs in those areas that need it.
Right.
That have resource, you know, limited resources, things like that. My mother-in-law, who's the former mayor of Crowley, used to always joke with me. She'd say, you know, here in Crowley, we farm. We feed the world with what we farm. You feed the neighborhood. But then, because
mother's-in-law, yeah. But, who's beautiful. She's gorgeous.
Well, thank you. But then she always qualified it saying, but there's a lot of neighborhoods that need feeding.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
That was always her point was, you know, there's a balance in all of these approaches to agriculture that none is a replacement for the other, but rather they all have a fit.
Mm-hmm.
So where we have focused the last few years really has been to address a unique need to deliver a fit in those areas that need it.
Right. It's beautiful, and I'm so proud to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's a lot to cover.
It
is. And I certainly hope that I haven't scared your listeners off.
No. I do have one interesting question before we give. Jason, do you have questions today? I have one quick one.
I know we're over time, but yeah. I do have one question.
Okay, sure. You ask it, and I've got one I'm going to close the show with.
Is there something that you haven't grown that interests you that you might do in the future?
Asparagus.
Oh, okay.
That's one that we're dying to grow. Our issue with asparagus is it tends to have a long time that you go from seed to actual first harvest. In some cases, it can be quite long. And our issue right now is, you know, we're space limited. Mm. So we really focus on those areas that our restaurants mm-hmm. really need.
Right.
Our next step as we evolve is to find the next location that we can really scale up and do what we want to do. And that would be one.
Awesome.
Cool.
I like that. Thank you for being here. This has been fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm glad you're still awake.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. It's good. You don't even have a cup of coffee.
I really wish that my wife and my father would have been here because they're amazing green thumbs, and they would have had a ton of questions for you.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I will say this. I know we're over time, but I mean, if you're editing stuff, you can perhaps figure out what you want. But one thing that we also have seen in all of this process is when we talk about veterans, we've had World War II veterans that come out that it's the most amazing thing to see. I'm not a scientist, but I can tell you as a layman, what I have observed has been a lot of these folks will come and they have memory issues where they can't remember, you know, dementia. But as soon as they get their hands on seeds, it cascades back. Suddenly they're back on the farm talking about how they grew up in Cecilia. You know, propagating camellias, and it's amazing to see that the parents, you know, our parents, my mom, you know, grew up on farms. You eat what you kill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we don't know that today. So it is. It's a lot of fun for parents to come back to. And it's part of why I love all of this stuff, too, is it's multi-generational. It not only do we have kids that can follow farmers, we can connect them to their elders, which
and that
has
helps
been
both. That helps
sure.
all of them.
It really is.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, I do have one quick question. I know in your early career, way before hydroponics and all these other legal things, you were out in L.A. and you saw a young Brad Pitt. I wanted to get that in. That
well,
you
let's clarify.
Saw that.
Let's clear. I didn't see a young Brad Pitt. What we did was I fell into the film industry after. When I was at LSU, I started an oil company, and I started it with my dad. So that would be a whole other story for a whole other rainy day. And I learned to hate the oil industry because my risk tolerance was not my dad's. However, my takeaway from that was, well, gee, I didn't go into banking, I didn't go into insurance, but I got a finance degree. What do I know how to do? I know how to deal with a crew of people that's always getting injured, maybe blowing things up. Sounds like the film industry.
Action movies.
So I got into the film industry thinking, well, gee, if it's going to be a 90% chance of failure, just like drilling, at least your worst case scenario is you can go sell to Germany and Japan, and you don't necessarily do the environmental damage. So maybe you can get back your budget. And that's really how I started in the film industry after LSU. So we did three of them you never heard of. But they did very well in Japan and Germany.
It worked out.
And one of the films was written for Brad Pitt by a gentleman named Sandy Tung, who was a director that directed him in his first show called Across the Tracks with Ricky Schroeder, who was at the time the bigger star. Mm-hmm. And Sandy wrote the script for Brad Pitt. But then by the time he wanted to make the film, Brad Pitt had already done Thelma and Louise, and he was long gone. So this was a script that had been floating around, and we made that. And in fact, to bring it all full circle, some of those folks that were involved in that film were the ones that reached out to me 5 years ago and said, hey, listen, we'd really like to put some veterans to work.
Full circle.
So yep.
It's beautiful. So, well, thank you
thank you so much.
Coley Franson with Helical Outpost. Look him up online. And I want to thank you for what you're doing for our community and for the world. And Jason Sikora, thank you for taping us here in Raider Solutions.
Thank you for being here.
And to our listeners, thank you for supporting the show. Please share the show. You can find it at discoverlafayette.net, or you can subscribe and get your podcast delivered each Friday. You can get this through iTunes or anywhere you get your podcast. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, I'm Jan Swift.